Welcome, investors, to the Absolute Return Podcast, your source for stock market analysis, global macro musings, and hedge fund investment strategies. Your hosts, Julian Klimochko and Michael Kesslering, aim to bring you the knowledge and analysis you need to become a more intelligent and wealthier investor. This episode is brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at AccelerateShares.com.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Absolute Return Podcast. I'm Julian Klimochko. I'm here with my co-host, Mike Kesslering. And on today's podcast, we have special guest, George Arison. George is the founder and CEO of Shift, an online peer-to-peer marketplace for buying and selling used cars. Shift recently went public via a special purpose acquisition company called Insurance Acquisition. Prior to Shift, in 2007, George co-founded Taxi Magic, now known as Curb. In today's podcast, we talk with George about Shift's founding, how the business developed from startup to public company, the going public process, why they used a SPAC to go public, and how Shift is positioned in the market. Please enjoy today's podcast with Shift CEO George Arison. All right, great. Welcome, George, to the podcast. We're happy to have you on the Absolute Return Podcast. How are you today?
Good, thank you. How are you?
Doing well, thanks. Let's start things off just by giving us a quick overview of your background. Tell our podcast listeners your entrepreneurial experience throughout your career and what brought you, the experience that brought you to being the founder and CEO of Shift.
Yeah, well, thanks for having me. So I'm originally from Georgia, the country. I moved to US when I was 14 to go to high school and have lived here pretty much ever since, with the exception of about a year and a half when I went back to Georgia to run a political campaign. I did not think I was going to do technology kind of company building when I got out of college. I had studied political science, and that's what I thought I was going to spend most of my career on. But after the campaign that I did in Georgia, it felt like it made sense to learn some business, because a lot of reasons, but kind of just seemed like a right transition. And, from that standpoint, I went to work at BCG, which kind of opened up, the rest of my career in terms of what I do now and where I've gone. It was a really amazing experience to be at BCG in terms of learning about business, drinking a lot of from the fire hose for the first 6 months, obviously, because I didn't have any clue of what I was talking about and or doing, but learned a ton. My mentor in life and whatnot, named Tom DePasquale, and my co-founder at Shift, who was also my best friend from college, Toby Russell, and a few other folks, and I all then started a company called Taxi Magic in 2007. This is a very early days of mobile. The BlackBerry is still the primary phone. iPhone does not yet even close to exist. You can't really push apps on a BlackBerry in an easy way and whatnot. But we had this view that mobile was going to be the next big platform, and that ground travel was a really great area for mobile technology, right? Because kind of from on-demand services perspective.
Right.
So we built a company that allowed people to book a taxi on a mobile phone, integrated with the dispatch systems of cab companies. And so you would put the reservation directly into the system, and then would allow you for payment through that system as well. The product worked really, really well, but consumers use the product very differently from how we envisioned. We thought that you would need to do both booking and payment, but people only wanted to do booking. And of course, the issue of how do you enable this on BlackBerry was always very complicated and hard. When the iPhone came out, it got a lot easier, because now there was an app store you could, have people download quite easily. The first day we were live in the iPhone app store, we had like 30,000 downloads, which back then was a massive, massive number. I mean, I guess it's still a big number today, but in 2008, 2009, it was really high. And we were one of the first kind of on-demand apps on the iPhone, and Apple used us in a newspaper ad and other commercials. But ultimately, we had a massive dependency on the cab companies, and that was a problem because the quality of the service they were providing was not great. So eventually, obviously, the reason Uber and Lyft, really Lyft in particular, worked very well is because they improved on that dramatically, and then Uber copied Lyft, and you have the kind of current iteration of the ride-sharing world. My green card was rejected in 2009, and I needed to decide what to do before my H-1B ran out. And so I actually left Taxi Magic in 2010 because of that issue. And I ended up joining Google because both I thought it was going to be a good learning experience, but also because I need to go to a place that was really good at green cards. And so spent a little bit of time there, got my green card, learned a ton, met a lot of great people. But I knew that I was going to start another company. And so then, you know, once that was all over in 2013, I started working on Shift and launched Shift as a business in December of 2013. We raised our first capital, and then we sold our first cards in 2014.
Did you raise capital at Taxi Magic?
We raised money at Taxi Magic, not traditional venture capital money. Our chairman and co-founder, Tom DePasquale, had done many companies previously, and all of them had done very well. And so he got investors to invest basically on a PowerPoint. This is, again, 2007, you know, you didn't raise as much on PowerPoints. Now you do more, but back then you actually had to have more traction. We raised a quote-unquote Series A, which was really a Series Seed, but, you know, same thing. And then we raised some additional capital from a company called Concur, which was a booking and booking tool for hotels and airline tickets. And for them, you know, for corporate travel, which is what Concur did, ground travel was a really big deal. And so they really had a lot of interest in figuring that out and moving it away from cash. And our thesis initially was this was primarily for corporate users. So yeah, we raised quite a bit of money while I was there. And then after I left, they raised some additional capital. But you know, part of the thinking behind moving to Google and moving to the West Coast was that East Coast companies just think very differently about things like this. And I think we were very constraining ourselves in terms of investment and spend and what we had to do to become better. It totally makes sense why we were doing it, because that's how it works on the East Coast, or it worked back then, at least on the East Coast. But what I wanted to do next was different. And so I think the West Coast was better for investing. But now, obviously, like, I'm guessing 5 years from now, it's going to be a totally different world because this whole idea of a West Coast company is going to disappear, I think.
Right. And that's a whole other topic in and of itself. But George, I want to focus on how the idea for Shift came about. And can you give us a bit of insight into the early days at Shift and its development, such as putting together a team, fundraising, product market fit, et cetera?
Shift, when I moved to the West Coast, Toby stayed on the East Coast, and we're very good friends outside of work. And so we would talk a lot, but we would actually do a formal, like, weekly talk on, let's talk about business ideas that we want to go after. And he's the one who actually first raised the idea of, hey, let's go after the, let's look at the automotive space. He and I had both just gone through a car purchase experience, which was really not great, mostly on the financing side of things. Like, the process of getting financing was pretty painful and frankly did not make any sense to us because we were not quite getting a loan from a bank was really tough unless you went through a dealer, and we're like, why does that happen? And so we kind of put that on the list of ideas to work after, and then we spent a ton of time learning about it. I became a car industry expert in some ways without really knowing anything about cars. I actually don't even drive. Learned a lot about where the issues were. And then I actually put together a team in 2013 that started to just run experiments. They would post cars on Craigslist to see what kind of feedback they'd get from potential buyers. They would reach out to people on Craigslist to see what kind of feedback they'd get from potential sellers, to try to understand pain points, because you can do a lot of surveying, but that's different from like what actual real consumers feel. And that was really, really helpful for us as well. It was a lot of research into figuring out what the business idea should be. And ultimately kind of developed into the current idea, which was, we would take the car away from the consumer and then sell it for them, right? So initially we thought, hey, we'd come into the existing transaction and help you with financing and warranty and whatnot, but ultimately it became clear that consumers actually didn't want that. They wanted us to do the full purchase experience. As far as, I knew nothing about fundraising, frankly, because at Taxi Magic I didn't really do much. So obviously, like, I had a sense of what VCs did from the side, but it wasn't really my job at Taxi Magic, and I just peripherally heard about what was going on. And, when I moved to the Bay Area in 2010, I would spend a reasonable amount of my free time getting to know VCs and learning about that. And, the first time, for a while, I was just kind of funding everything on my own. But eventually, the money was going to run out, so we had to raise money. And my future co-founder, John Washington, is the one who's like, hey, I think you should raise a convertible note, and I'll kind of help you do that. And he knew what convertible notes were because he had been an associate at Comcast Ventures, so obviously he dealt with that a lot. And so that's how we went after raising the first round of capital. You know, didn't really have a clue about what raising a convertible note meant, but just kind of said, okay, let's start by going after all the people we know, because we want people who we work with in some way to invest in us. That's a good signal to send. So let's go raise money from them, and then kind of snowball from there. And we end up raising, you know, $4 million for our seed round, which in 2013 was a lot of money. 2013, 14. Obviously today that's a more medium sized seed round, but, you know, 7 years ago, it was really big. As far as team building, you know, I think I learned at TaxiMagic, and more importantly, I learned at Google, that great teams are really, really critical. And so we did want to build an awesome team. Some of this happened just purely organically. You know, so Joel kind of joined in to help me with the raise, and then he's like, hey, I want to stay and work on this full time. So that made a ton of sense to us, or to me. Then my old boss at Google, in Ingersoll, invested in us in our very first seed round. And she is like, you know, I'm getting really interested in what you're doing. Like, what if I come and help you with some product? And then kind of got sucked in and joined in full time. I've been recruiting an engineer to join us for a long, long time. And then, you know, eventually got Christian Oler to come on board in, I think, April or May of 2014 as a co-founder. So once you kind of attract a few really great people as your initial kind of founding team, then it's a lot easier to hire great talent. And that's sort of the strategy that we took.
It's interesting, in the early days of Shift's development, and obviously your recent going public transaction is a massive leap forward in terms of the development of the business. And over time, have there been any other key milestones that you achieved that you felt really elevated the business onto the next stage?
I mean, for me, sort of everyone's still asking, like, is going public the biggest thing you've done in your life? And I don't think, I mean, it's obviously massive. I don't think it's the biggest thing I've done in my life. Because I do think that raising the Series A was the single biggest thing in my kind of professional career. Because that kind of, like, created basic validation for the business. But until that point, you're kind of, like, puttering around almost, and then, like, you're actually playing the real game. And, you know, most of the money I've raised as an entrepreneur has been not in Silicon Valley, but the most important money I raised was on Sand Hill Road. We were driving our new car yesterday as a test, and we took our kids on the highway, and to get to 280, you kind of go through Sand Hill Road from our house. And so, you know, I'm, like, telling my one-year-old, I'm like, well, this is Sand Hill Road. I'm like, Shift would not exist had we not successfully raised money right here. And so there is this, like, rite of passage a little bit in doing that. And, you know, I think that's really, really critical. And, you know, most founders don't actually appreciate the extent to which that initial capital is really important, not just from the point of view, like, hey, get stuff done, but also, like, the recognition that it sets you up for as a business moving forward. And so that is probably the single biggest, like, big factor in Shift's, you know, success. I think had we not done that well, then there'd be no Shift. From then on, you know, I think for us, in a weird way, COVID accelerated what we had anticipated would happen in the market for a long time in a much more rapid way. And so suddenly people started to value auto e-commerce in ways that they previously did not. And, you know, dealers who previously would ignore the idea that, hey, there's going to be some Shift happening here, started to, like, be like, oh, yeah, there's clearly a Shift happening here, and et cetera. And so I think that was a really big tipping point for us as well in terms of accelerating the move towards being a public company, et cetera, because we obviously always planned on being a public company. It always made sense. But this environment, it made sense to go faster and move in that direction quicker because the demand for a product is so high.
So when you looked at going public, you mentioned the importance of moving quickly. Was that the one of the main determinants on choosing a SPAC over an IPO or direct listing or another form of RTO? What were some of the other factors that you looked at in the go public process?
Yeah, I mean, direct listings, like, I just don't understand this focus on everybody's part. Because literally, I think there were three companies in the last 12 months that did a direct listing. And, like, you know, all those are unique and exceptional companies that, you know, have been either around for a really long time or have a founder who is worth billions of dollars or both, or have a massive user following, right? Like Spotify has a massive inherent investor base because they are, millions and millions and millions of people use it every day. And obviously, like, it might work for some companies, but that's just not realistic for the vast majority of companies, I think. So I think choices really are between a SPAC and a normal IPO. There are a few reasons why a SPAC, I think, makes sense for a company. One is speed, for sure. It is a faster process if you're starting from point zero. Now, if you've done a ton of work to get ready for an IPO, you've written your prospectus, your S1 has already been filed kind of privately with the SEC, et cetera, that's a different story. But if you're kind of going to be like, hey, day zero, I'm going to start working on my S1 now, right? At that point, an IPO path is much longer than a SPAC path. And it also allows you to kind of time the market really well because, frankly, a lot of IPO is not just about how well the business is doing, it's also how the market is doing. And so you might start an IPO process and the market is doing great, but every time you're ready to actually go out, the market is doing terrible, right? Like, is a real thing. Like DoorDash and Airbnb are both going to IPO in the next few weeks here. But like, had we had a truly contested election, right? Kind of like 2000, the market would be in a total tailspin right now and you wouldn't be able to go public. So, but they have been working on that for months and many quarters now. So timing is definitely, the speed is definitely one factor around SPAC. Second factor is around the fact that you can probably raise more capital in a SPAC transaction than you can in a traditional transaction. Because usually, underwriters are willing to underwrite something like 10, 15% of your enterprise value in an IPO, and in fact, you can do more. So those are kind of the two big things that for us mattered a ton when we thought about, SPAC versus an IPO.
And then when you were looking at, you've decided upon a SPAC, and you're looking at different SPAC sponsor teams, what were you looking at when you were comparing, because there is plenty of SPACs out there, there's a couple hundred SPACs out there currently. What were you looking at for when you're looking at the different vehicles?
Yeah, so when we were doing it, there were not a couple hundred SPACs out. This is like an explosion, right after kind of our deal was announced, frankly. Not that it was correlated by any means. But So for us, our bankers did a kind of look at the SPACs that were out there and cut them by size and by who were the sponsors of the SPACs and whatnot, and what the subject matters of the SPACs were, because some of them actually had a very like, hey, I'm in real estate or whatnot. For our enterprise value, a SPAC of like $150 to $200 million made the most sense. There's actually not that many SPACs at that price range, so a lot of the SPAC fundraising has been pushing prices like months raised to be higher and higher, $250, $300, $350, $400. But for us, it was too big, And then we wanted a really quality sponsor. So I think we really lucked out with the fact that the Coens did have a SPAC of like 155 or 150, something like that. And they're a very, very high quality sponsor. And the way you define a high quality sponsor is like they've done this before. So they know what the de-SPAC process is like. Because quite frankly, the raising the money for a SPAC is the easy part. It's the running the process afterwards that's the really hard part. There's a lot of very detailed work and you're almost like running a marathon, but at a sprint pace from the time when you kind of sign an LOI until you de-SPAC. So we signed an LOI June 7th or something like that, somewhere around then, and we de-SPAC on the 15th of October, I believe. And so like that period of time was just an insanely intense period when you do a ton of work that in a normal IPO you would do prior to the IPO. And so having somebody who had gone through the process was really, really critical, and obviously we lucked out in that regard quite well.
That's interesting. The way the business developed, you raised the Series A, which was the seminal event, really kicked off, made the business real, allowed you to build the team and start building the company. Then roughly 7 years later, it's time to go public. You really did a carefully selected SPAC sponsor in insurance acquisition with the Coens there, and they seemingly just had the right amount of cash for you guys. And then now you're a fully public company. So why don't you tell us about that, perhaps from a customer's perspective? Why don't you tell us about the appeal of utilizing Shift for the customer versus, potential other ways they could go about the same process or some of your competitors?
So look, I mean, the used car market is massive, right? Like, it's nearly $850 billion, and there's going to be many, many different ways in which a person can buy a car for a long time, because this is not a winner-take-all type of situation. A vast majority of the market is either private party sales, so like, I buy a car from you or you buy a car from me, or, you know, smaller dealerships. And these smaller dealerships can be either individual, like, used car-only lots, or, you know, smaller groups of franchise dealerships. I own 3-4 stores in, you know, Northern California or something like that. And you know, the big dealership groups like AutoNation, Lithia, Penske, whatnot, they're tiny in the ecosystem overall just because the market is so big. So that's the traditional kind of way of doing things. And then you have three up-and-comers that are of different sizes, Carvana, of Vroom and Shift, that are doing the digital kind of transformation of the of this model towards a more e-commerce transaction. You know, I think all three of us just fundamentally differ from the traditional way of buying a car because we all do it online. By the way, like, all of us have great NPS scores compared to the traditional dealers, and so consumers clearly love the experience. But all three of us combined are like less than 1% of the market by a lot. So a ton of market share to capture here. Between the three of us, there's, you know, fundamental differences from the consumer point of view, where Carvana and Vroom are more alike and Shift is quite different. We offer a test drive to the consumer versus they don't. So with Shift, if you want to buy a car, you can do a test drive before buying the car, and then you can buy a car in your driveway. With Vroom and Carvana, you buy the car sight unseen and then it's shipped to you. You can do that with Shift as well, meaning we will give you the choice to buy a car online and then we'll ship it to you. But that's not kind of the core offering. The core offering is the one with a test drive. The result of that difference in the kinds of ways we sell a car with is that we actually, differ vis-a-vis the type of inventory that we sell. So Shift's inventory is, generally speaking, older. And we have a segment of cars that we call value, which are, cars that are below cars that are over 8 years and old or 80,000 miles. And those cars, you know, you really can't sell without test drive. And that's something that's very unique and differentiated to us that you know, most people don't have.
That's interesting. You mentioned this massive total addressable market, used car market in the U.S. is just huge. And obviously, no one really has much of a significant market share at all. So that opportunity is clear. Why don't you give us and our listeners the quick investment pitch and your case for why an investor should consider Shift shares?
Partly this very diverse inventory. Right, that we sell a full spectrum of inventory and we can capture share from a ton of different kind of parts of the ecosystem. Secondly, we are more localized in our model, meaning we go after deep markets in each, deep penetration in each market that we open into, so we're not national. That's obviously, something that is more expensive to do if you're going to go national versus going local. So our focus is to capture as much share as you can in the markets that we are in versus being everywhere. Thirdly, like, we have really amazing technology. Oftentimes I'm asked, like, well, how do you prioritize investments? Well, we've always been under capitalized as a business until now, or that we're now public. And so we've always had to make very tough choices. And that's actually good because it forces you to be very careful with spend. But for us, you know, historically speaking, technology was a really big part of our investment because we thought that we had to kind of build this baseline of tech that we could then build on. And now moving forward, it's actually less as a percentage of total spend will be coming down. That's one differentiator between us and everybody else is the fact that we have this really strong technical layer.
Interesting. Well, thanks so much, George, for coming onto the podcast. Before we close things out today, where can investors see more of you online, whether it be social media, YouTube, your website?
Yeah, so investors.shift.com is our investor relations page. So obviously all the press releases and filings and whatnot are there. I'm George Arison on LinkedIn and Twitter as well. I'm not a heavy Twitter user by any means because I actually have to run a business, and so don't have the time to be on Twitter, but more heavy LinkedIn user because, frankly, I don't know how people build companies before LinkedIn. It's like one of the most amazing things for my job. But those are the two places I'm directed to.
Okay, perfect. Well, thank you so much for coming on the Absolute Return podcast. Definitely enjoyed your insights into entrepreneurship, the building of Shift, the SPAC process, and all the key insights that you shared with our audience today. So thank you very much, George.
Awesome. Thank you very much.
All right. Thanks, bye, everybody.
Thanks for tuning in to the Absolute Return Podcast. This episode was brought to you by Accelerate Financial Technologies. Accelerate, because performance matters. Find out more at accelerateshares.com. The views expressed in this podcast are the personal views of the participants and do not reflect the views of Accelerate. No aspect of this podcast constitutes investment, legal, or tax advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast should not be viewed as a recommendation or solicitation of an offer to buy or sell any securities or investment strategies. The information and opinions in this podcast are based on current market conditions and may fluctuate and change in the future. No representation or warranty, expressed or implied, is made on behalf of Accelerate as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this podcast. Accelerate does not accept any liability for any direct, indirect, or consequential loss or damage suffered by any person as a result of relying on all or any part of this podcast, and any liability is expressly disclaimed.